Hello, welcome to the first ever live philosophy podcast. It's nice to have you all here. I don't know how this works. I've never done one live before. This is normally a podcast I just do out the back of my house, and I have a chat with somebody about, you know, I guess life and what life is all about. And this is the first day of the Yak Festival. Here, this is a three-week festival of like creative shows and interesting ideas, and they asked me if I would be involved in some way, and I didn't have any other fucking ideas. So suddenly you're seeing this show live. It was never meant to be a live show. I normally say to the guests on the show, say whatever you want, and then like if you've said too much in the show, we can just cut it out. Like there's been a few times over the years, if you've not heard the Osher Ginsberg podcast, if you have heard it, the ghosts are some pretty deep places, and fuck, you should hear the other 20 minutes. there's a couple of things over the years that I've cut out. So here's what I need you guys to do here today. I guess to get the best out of our guests and to be able to go to the places that the podcast normally goes to, this has to be a safe space, I guess, today. So if our guest says something up here that he later decides he doesn't want to put in the podcast, I'm going to cut it out. But you guys are going to know it. So, shh. You've got to make an agreement that you keep it to yourself, right? Okay, that seems like a good idea. I haven't announced who the guest is. I'm very excited to have him here. It's someone that I've always wanted to talk to about the meaning of life. It's Stu from The Bachelor. And I've got some great questions, like, where the fuck's Sophie? And they're not together anymore. But I love how well, like, my philosophy crowd is also a fucking Bachelor crowd. So that's given me a little insight to what's going on here. So it's going to start. I don't really know what's going to go on, but we're just going to have a conversation up here. I hope it's going to be really fun and interesting for you guys. By round of applause, I guess I just should find out who has heard the normal podcast before. Clap your hands. And by round of applause, who has never heard the podcast before? Okay, a lot of people who were just like, fuck it. Don't care, I don't have an iPod, but I want to see what this podcast is about. I should explain to you guys what it's actually about then. You're like, does the podcast always just have you by yourself banging on about shit annoyingly at the start? Yes, yes it does. And ha ha ha, you can't skip through it live. So you're fucking stuck. Anyway, so... I have this podcast. I have a bunch of other podcasts. So I have an original podcast called TOEFOLT with my friend Charlie Clawson, and then that span off into another podcast called FOFOLT, where I talk to comedians. And this guest today, he's been a guest on my FOFOLT podcast before. And then Charlie and I have an AFL football podcast called Two Guys, One Cup. If it's your first time on the internet, just be careful Googling that one. But put in AFL or you might get some very disturbing images. And last but not least, there's this one. It's called Philosophy with Will Anderson. I didn't want to put my name in the title of it, but I did it for a while, and then I stopped doing it for a while, and iTunes went, fuck you, you don't own the rights to your own podcast, so I had to change the name. So now it's called Philosophy with Will Anderson. And basically, I interview a person that I know about life. I ask them if they have a philosophy towards anything, and then we just have a chat about, you know, life. So I hope that you guys are going to enjoy that. That's what you're in for today. Here's how it's going to start. So, I am making this up as I go along. It's the first one. We're all in this together. So, ladies and gentlemen, here's what's going to happen. We'll play the intro music. I'll sit down, and then the guest will come out while the intro music is playing. So this will kind of be the start of the official podcast. He will sit down in this chair. You'll all cheer because it's the start of the podcast, and also some of you will recognise who the person is, and you'll cheer. And some of you might not know who the person is yet, but you will get to know them over the next 4 or 5 hours. And you know it goes for 4 or 5 hours, right, mate? And and then we will get on with the podcast. Okay, so that's how it'll work. So I reckon
Without any further ado, it's probably time that we can start this. So I'm going to sit down, we'll play the intro music, my guests will walk out, you'll all cheer, we'll start the podcast. Okay, hang on. You know what? Before we start, I'm just going to... Because this will be... I was like, I'll just have wine. And then there was beer backstage. Anyway, they will not be used by me, so let's just put those... over there. Normally I'm doing this in the privacy of my own home, so I can hide from people. Well, not really, I can hide from... Anyway, I do these long intros normally for the podcast. You're getting a little taste of it now. And normally I'm doing them late at night, and I've already had a few drinks, and when I've got on my own with a microphone, I can bang on. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's get this underway. I'm going to sit down, the music will play, our guests will come out, we'll start the podcast. Welcome to the first ever live Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson and I am joined by a very special guest. I'm very excited to have him here at Giant Dwarf as part of the Yak Festival. My guest, who are you?
Ronnie Chang. Yay!
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for having me. Can I first say that you are a real inspiration for me in comedy and in hair? Thank you so much. I've been trying to get your hairstyle for a couple of years now. It took me a while to figure it out.
I enjoy that you've started this live podcast with a visual reference.
Yeah.
Because it gives it a reason to exist.
Yeah, dude, let's do it. How does it, how are you feeling? You okay? Your health? You all good?
Ronnie's going to interview me for the podcast. Yeah, I've had a really bad back. That's why we're sitting in these kind of high chairs.
No, I know. I mean, I would have a bad back too if I was supporting the entire Australian podcast industry. On my shoulders. How many? You got like five on just spinning off. They keep spinning off. Well, the next one will be the wine one. From all the wine we drank on Willosophy, we just start a wine podcast now.
Well, you know what? I would start a weed podcast before a wine podcast. Yeah. But you're not allowed to smoke weed indoors at Giant Dwarf. So
find a place, man.
Oh, yeah. No, I've found a place. There's an abandoned children's park out there. Ladies and gentlemen, it's nice to have you here, Ronnie. Thank you very much for coming along. I ask everybody on the podcast if they have a philosophy towards anything. Do you? Is there one in particular that you have?
Yeah, let's do it, man. Let's talk about shit. Let's get fired. This is a safe space.
Who are we going to get fired from?
From anything. Let's just say what we want to say. Let's let it all out today.
Okay. Well, what do you want to say? Say it.
Well, I think it's when you ask me that, it's so tough because I was trying. My philosophy was I couldn't. I didn't want to. I don't know what my philosophy is because I felt like I'm 32. I'm still learning stuff. I shouldn't really be too fixed in anything. I realized that that's kind of a life philosophy then.
Mate, 32. You've got to know some stuff by 32. By 32, Jesus was almost dead.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't. You know, I don't know. I just feel like every time I look at something, I'm like, I have no idea how to do that. So I shouldn't be commenting on it. That's my life philosophy. If you don't know anything, shut up. It seems to be the life philosophy, yeah.
I mean, that is actually a pretty good philosophy, I've got to be honest with you. Yeah. Because sometimes, of course, we're friends on the World Wide Web, the internet.
Yes.
Where you're often, you know, hitting me up with messages on Twitter and Facebook complaining about the fact that my website is shit.
Yeah. I'm begging you to please let me fix your website. The guy supporting the Australian podcast industry deserves a better website than what you have. It's like, I don't even know what's on it.
I loved it. Ronnie, for those of you who don't know, and we will get to it, of course, has recently moved to New York City to be part of The Daily Show. Yeah. And when you first got there, you know, it's your brand new job, you're there in New York City, and then in the middle of the night, I just get this message from you going, can I fix your website?
I was fixing Anthony Morgan's website. That's why it went to you, because I was like, Anthony Morgan's website is bad. Let me see who else. Oh, man, Wills. Come on. It's unacceptable. But also, when I moved there, I think this ties into what I was talking about. I'm always trying to learn more from other people than teach. I'm always trying to learn more. So when I first, before I moved to America, I got in touch with you. I asked you to show me the ropes, remember? You're very kindly, as he's very sincere and generous with his time, he invited me to his home in Sydney to come and talk about moving to America, and he told me to give up.
So there's no roles for Asians.
Yeah. He said, it's very tough. I've tried. I couldn't do it. I doubt you'll be able to do it. So, no, he gave me a lot of good advice about dealing with agents and managers and lowering my expectations and how to navigate that whole world. So it's really invaluable.
Well, why don't we start there? Because that's as good a place there to start. We can work backwards. Sure. Moving to, you were very much starting to establish yourself here in Australia as being like one of the leading sort of younger comics on the scene, you know, selling huge numbers live, you know, doing a lot of work here. Yes. And then suddenly The Daily Show comes along. Yeah. You know, the biggest... you know, news comedy show really in the world, the most prestigious news comedy show in the world, you know, a legacy show.
Sure.
And it means you have to move to New York City and you're thrown into the mix with a guy, Trevor Noah, going into a brand new job following someone who was like a beloved American sort of icon in that job. So very hard for Trevor to be doing, but also very hard for the people that Trevor was going to take with him.
Yeah.
Coupled with the fact that you're suddenly moving to a place that you had not lived before. Yeah. So take us back to that moment and where your life was at then.
Yeah, so I was killing it in Australia, just fucking destroying everything. And then Australia was always has always been really good to me. You know, I started comedy here.
That was actually why I gave him good advice about overseas. I was like, fuck off and leave me alone.
I got good, great, lots of good shout outs from Will Anderson in the newspaper a lot, which helped a lot with selling tickets. So I was doing okay, and I got the email to audition for The Daily Show, and we're kind of trained, I don't know about you, maybe not you so much, but the rest of us male mortals are trained to get auditions and just go, yeah, we're never going to get it, and then we just dismiss it. So getting an audition wasn't a big deal. I got it, I was like, it'll be fun, but you kind of, you know, you turn it down your head so you don't get.
And when you say the audition for this, how does like an audition for? Because I can imagine people in this audience might go, well, for an actor, you get a scene from the show and you have to like, you know, learn that scene and you have to do that. But when you're auditioning for something to be a correspondent on The Daily Show, what form does that audition take?
So they ask you to come up, write your own segment, and perform a segment they've done. And you submit that.
Okay, so you're performing one that they've already done on the show. Yeah. Tell me about the other one. You have to write something of your own.
Yeah.
So this is interesting to me. What can you remember what topic you
I
wrote
do.
About?
I know, but you want to let people see how the sausage is made? All right, well...
Yes, this is what this is about.
So what happened was, you know, you get the audition and it's very rare to get opportunities like that. So my thing was, I'm going to do something I do in my stand-up show already, because I felt like if... I did the best I could and I didn't get it, I could live with that. If I try to be Will Anderson and make something up on the spot and I don't get a job, I'll be very disappointed. So I went with something safe. I happened to have a joke in my hour at the time that was semi-political and about social media or something. And I was just
and you turned that into a piece.
Into a desk piece, me and Trevor.
Did you find out? Was there a process? Is it one of those ones where you audition and then there's another step in the process?
Yeah. Then I submitted, then the next step was, hey, can you do that again? So write a new one and then do another piece we did. So I did it in my Melbourne apartment on my Mac, on the little photo booth, like yelling into the little camera, trying to make it look like a studio in the back, right? With your like clothes hangers. And so I submitted that, and then, a couple weeks later, they told me I got the job. And I was in Edinburgh at the time, which, as you know, can be a tough place mentally. during the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, it's the largest live performing arts festival on the planet. You know, like 5,000 shows going on. It's a real jungle, and I was in the middle of it. That valley in the middle where you're just, I want to go home. And then they told me that I got the show, the Daily Show, which meant that I couldn't go home anymore. I had to go to New York to like a new city. But you know, it was a real thrill, obviously. And I, looking back, I asked Trevor, I suspected that Trevor had a hand in like shoving this through, because no one wants this. Like, this is the least desirable minority.
What do you mean by that?
Asian men is the least desirable. No one wants Asian men on television. Yeah, not even Asian men want Asian men on television. Yeah. This is the least desirable, you know, like Asian women above us. Like, everyone's above us. Asian men is like, that's the least desirable to have on TV. And Trevor's like, no, we're doing it. We're putting this guy on. So he stuck his neck out for me. and I suspect
he's like, I'm a black South African in America. I need someone who's lower on the title pole than me.
Yeah. And he's always a lot, so I'm that guy. And I suspect that he put me on because I did a show with him. Actually, this goes back, and we can probably tie this into a philosophy of life. This goes back to Montreal in 2013.
So Montreal is, well, you've talked about two festivals there. And because there's kind of big three comedy festivals, and they're all kind of instrumental in both of our lives in a lot of ways, which is the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, which I'm sure we'll get back to. There's the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which is a huge arts festival that has a huge comedy component to it.
Yeah.
And then there's the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal, which is more like a trade convention, that a comedy festival is incidentally involved with.
Sure, yeah. And the one thing I got out of that is that everything's a bubble, right? In life, we have our own bubbles, for better or for worse. So comedy, it's its own bubble. Like for us, I remember talking to you about this when I first got invited to JFL. Just for Laughs, you get invite only. And so I was 2-3 years into comedy, I got invited. I was like, oh my God, this is the biggest deal ever. And you would keep going. You always went to JFL, even though you didn't need to.
Well, I mean, you know, like the big dream of JFL is you go to JFL and then someone discovers you and puts you on the Daily Show. I've been 10 times and no one's been. I'm like, I'm still here. And they're like, yeah, no, we know.
No, so thank you.
Have you got Ronnie's number? Can we get Ronnie's number off you?
Yeah, thanks much for the advice. And you were hosting JFL. It was so everything's a bubble, right? And I guess it helps to have some perspective on that. We put all these places on pedestals sometimes, the Comedy Cellar, Just for Laughs, and it's kind of important to, like, not... I think as comics, it's funny, like, part of our job is to make fun of institutions, right? We make fun of it, and suddenly you do it long enough or you happen to go a certain way and suddenly you're part of an institution. That you're like, we started out to make fun of these guys, like, and suddenly we're part of this thing, we're trying to get jobs, we're compromising, whatever artistic
integrity. It can get you in trouble, too, which I found out at the Logies one year. But I was like, fuck, I'm making fun of you all. Oh, fuck, I'm part of this. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, so JFL happens.
I got to do a show with Trevor. I happened to be on the same show with him. It was Eddie Izzard's gala, and I did a 10-minute spot there. It went really well. Trevor really liked it. He told me at the time, he was like, hey, I'd love to get you down to South Africa and do the comedy festival there. I was like, yeah, anytime. And then I didn't speak to him for 3 years. And he never gave me his number. We never messaged at all. And then 3 years later, I just get this email from the production company. And I suspected it was him. But otherwise, how would they be looking over here in Australia, right? They casted their net in America. You know the networks in America. It's so there's so many people to choose from already. So Trevor and I confirmed with Trevor about a year into the job. I was like, hey, did you put them onto me? He was like, yeah, of course. Do you think they want you without me saying okay? You're the least desirable minority. Like, it's not for me. You owe me everything. I was like, okay, fair enough. I owe him everything, yeah.
So
the philosophy from that is like, I don't usually talk in parables, but I feel like this podcast demands it, was like, you don't know where it's gonna lead. You just be ready. It's like M&M vomiting spaghetti, right? You just gotta be ready. Yeah, you are ready, you want to be over-prepared for the moment where you can, you don't want to just have 10 minutes, you want to have 20, or now hopefully more than 20, but you don't want to just scrape by, you want to be ready, because you never know where the opportunities come from. So I was just doing the show, I mean, it was a JFL gala, it was a big deal, but you don't know where it's going to lead, and the payoff was only 2 years later, two, three years later, so you don't know whether...
Okay, so let's concentrate on that idea for a minute, because I like that, the idea of you not knowing when it's going to pay off. You know, if you may be doing the thing at the moment that it leads to that next big thing, that next big break, but you might not find out that you're doing it until 2 or 3 years later. I think that's a really interesting idea. When you first started doing comedy, where did you start doing it?
And that's a good point. Yeah, I started doing it. My first show was at University of Melbourne. We did a campus comedy competition, just trying to be silly. And then my second gig, which is kind of like my first gig in the public, was at Kaz Rytop's Dirty Secrets on Wednesdays on Smith Street in Melbourne. Yeah, you go down there and, you know, and then you get caught in this weird addiction of, like, trying to jump on stage and make people laugh.
So how did you though, because you were at university, Melbourne University, you're studying,
Law
and Commerce, right? Yeah, yeah. So, you know, smart guy at university, you know.
Good looking.
Yeah. Least desirable minority for television.
Yeah. It's a contradiction we worked out,
yeah. Exactly.
Good looking, least desirable.
So comedy seems to me, for a guy who is as competent and driven and the background that you have, seems to me like something that is still a bit of a dog leg, a left turn. What was it that made you interested or made you think that you were a person who was going to do comedy?
Yeah, this is a great, I mean, it leads me to something else I discovered when I was in New York, was that, there was something I thought I could do it. It was something I thought I could do, I just wanted to confirm that suspicion. And it was never intended to go past that first show. It was just like, oh, yeah, I did it, and then we can carry on with our lives. And then it just became this weird obsession, as you know. The drug of trying to write that better bit, write that better joke. And I had a moment in New York City where I was performing at the Comedy Cellar. I just got passed at the Comedy Cellar, which is another bubble, another institution that we kind of put on a pedestal. And I got passed there, and I was performing there. The first time I performed there, and I just had this moment, which I've only had like maybe twice in my life, of like, I was very much in the present, just doing the jokes, and like, oh yeah, this is great. I'm loving it. I don't even care what happens next. Like, this is, you know, there was no more worries, no more, you won't worry about the future or the past. Yeah, that's it. So I guess everyone trying to find that thing that you love doing, that samurai mentality, right? Of like, just do it because you like doing it, right? Like, it doesn't even matter about how you're going to monetize this, or you just love doing it, just go and do it. You know, that passion is so hard to find. Like, I saw that McLaren documentary. Do you see that one about Bruce McLaren? About the New Zealand F1 driver. It made me love F1, made me love cars, made me love New Zealanders, white guys. That documentary is just a great program. Because there was this guy, he was this New Zealand guy who he had a physical deformity, one leg longer than the other, and he was bedridden for months, I think, and then he just loved racing cars. His dad was a mechanic, and he was racing cars, and he's 17 years old, was racing cars, and got picked up by an F1 team, and then won the F1 championship at 21. These guys literally risking their lives every week just because they just love doing it. You know, just the passion of it. You could tell in how he...
Yeah, but technically, it's almost cheating driving around in circles when one leg is longer than the other. I mean, you've been walking around in circles all your life. You've got a natural affinity to fucking circles.
Sure. Okay, that's true.
Probably easier to fucking do the clutch. Like, there's a lot of... That's cheating. Take back his fucking championships. That's what I say.
Yes, nothing means anything. overcoming the odds. it was great. And so I guess the point of... to answer your question on what made you do comedy is, I don't know, this weird thing you want to do. And you have to get into that. I don't want to get racial with this stuff. I don't know. I'm not white, so I don't know if it's different for white people. I think Asian people, it's tough to find that thing that you can do without worrying about the future and how to monetize it. I think we all face that to some extent. I don't think it's a race thing. But
There seems to at least be stereotypically a race element to that.
Sure.
I mean...
You said it, not me, so...
You led me into it. Was this a trap? Have you trapped me with your fucking Daily Show skills? Do the whole interview. I think I've gone fine. Then you edit it and I'm a racist.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know how the Daily Show works. So, it's one of those things where there is culturally for white people, where kind of the idea of the tiger mum, or that idea that, like, for some reason, this Asian family is coming to this country and forcing their kids into working harder than the rest of the kids and all this. So it's the stereotype, even if it isn't the reality.
Sure. And so there was that. I mean, in my show, now that we're on the Tiger Mom thing, in my TV show, Rancho International Student, I mean, I had my mom like that, a Tiger Mom. But one thing I wanted to show in the TV show, which I hope I portrayed correctly, was the other side of that coin. That there's a lot of, it's very, your parents can be very demanding and very strict, but there's also a lot of love that comes with that. And I think that's the stereotype that we don't usually see. I mean, yes, it's a stereotype. Asian moms are very demanding on their kids or whatever, but you never see the love in it, which I try to portray in the TV.
How much do you think, and because you are a person that, it's certainly in your approach to comedy, there are some people who get into comedy because, let's be honest, they don't really like to work.
And it's quite an easy way to make money without working that hard, you know what I mean?
Maybe for you, but the rest of us are working very hard to try to get jokes out, man.
No, but I mean, there is an element of some people who get into comedy because they like the lifestyle of comedy. Whereas there's some people who I think if you're giving up something else or if you have something, you work hard at comedy in a way. Like,
sure.
The approach that I've had to comedy, because I know that I've never been, you know, the funniest person in the room, but I... like, knew that if
I
worked
hard...
You
know how many people are here to see you? So I don't know what you mean, man.
No. They all came for the mystery guests. I kind of implied it was Russell Crowe. But I... yeah, he'll be out in a minute, guys. It'll be fine. No, I knew that I wanted to work hard at it. Like, you know, that my approach would be that I'm going to work as hard at this as I would at anything else that I would do to try to make it work. And I wonder if the fact that you have other options means that your approach to comedy, when you come into it, you don't take it for granted. You throw yourself into it a bit.
Maybe. I mean, I actually had one foot out the door the whole time I was doing comedy until I got The Daily Show. I was always like, I think it's time to quit now. I think it's...
And what were you imagining? By the way, I think about quitting every day, but I've now been doing this long enough that I'm not qualified for anything else. I have an imaginary radio show. And I...
So you think about quitting every day? That's crazy.
Every day.
Really?
Every day.
That's crazy.
Man, like, I think about, like, when I'm on planes and there's turbulence, I fucking pray that the plane crashes every fucking time.
Did you?
Because I'm so busy, I'm like, it'd just be a relief.
Did you say that out loud? Is that how you got arrested? Did you go, I'm so fucking tired of life? And everything, if this thing goes down, I swear to God, it'll be easy on all of us. And then they say, what are you doing? I'm Will Anderson. You know what, the gruen?
You know, the funny thing about that was, I was next to this woman on the plane the other day, and she was 84 years old, and it was the first time that she'd flown in like 30 years or something.
Oh,
and she was really nervous, and she had one of those old school like brick phones.
She's not smoking as well, because she didn't realize the laws changed.
Well, basically, she said to me, she goes, I've never turned my phone off. She didn't know how to turn it off, and she didn't have the passcode to turn if she turned it off to get it back on. And she's like, do you think that like the plane will crash if I don't turn it off? And I'm like, just put it in your bag. And she goes, I should tell them. I said, don't tell them, just put it in your bag. And she's like, are you serious? And I'm like, trust me, it's fine. Like, and then we chatted for the whole 2 hours. And then afterwards, she's like, I'm going to Google you. And then I realized the first thing that will come up. It's like, why the fuck was I taking advice from that guy? It's an airline criminal.
Unsuccessful attempt to get us all killed. That's really funny.
When you say foot out the door, I mean, we all have... I make gigs sometimes think about... halfway through a joke, I'm like, well, this is it. I knew the day was coming. I guess this is it. It's all over.
But I think the thing is, and that goes back to the reason why you're doing it, right? So what I've noticed is... because if you're doing stand-up comedy, it's a bubble, so I'm not... it's the only thing I can speak expertly about, so...
We're going to talk about the world as well, okay. But, like, people are used to us talking about stand-up comedy on this because it's what I talk about.
Sure, but I don't want to make it sound like I think it's the be-all and end-all, but in comedy, if you do it to get famous or to get rich, it's like, if that's your motivation, I don't know if you can ever get rich or famous enough to... you know, satisfy...
Or to make it worth it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's got to be a bit of it, well, I believe, and I'm sure it's different for every person, but I do think there is something about, if we're being completely honest with ourselves, if you really love comedy and you give yourself over to it, what you're actually saying is, I want to pursue something forever that I know that I can never truly master. Like, I am willing to be a surfer, right? Yeah. You'll have that day where you catch those perfect waves, but the next day that same wave's going to fucking dump you in the middle of the ocean. You've signed up to the idea of trying to continually master something that at its very heart can't be mastered. Because even if you get those jokes perfectly, say you're going to record your special, right? And you get the jokes exactly where you want to get them. And on that night, you have the audience exactly where you want them. If you went away for 5 years and let people move on and then came back and tried to do those exact same set of jokes, they wouldn't work in the same way, right?
It's a living art.
It's a living art.
It's like Jiro Dreams of Sushi. You guys know that documentary, that guy pursuing
the perfect sushi and never achieving it. And yeah, so that's crazy. Do you know that documentary?
No.
Jiro Dreams of Sushi. It's, yeah, everyone. You, yeah, you guys know. Yeah.
No. Oh, yeah. Okay. Fucking inner city Redfern crowd. I'm a bloody white Australian, and my only documentary is Barry Dreams of Pies. Like, that's
a... there must be a pie maker who goes through that with the same intensity, right?
Yeah, I guess yeah. there would be. So, what is your approach now? What is your approach now to comedy?
Like, oh, now, now it's like nothing matters. You can never be famous enough. You can never be rich enough. So just do it for the fun, right? Try to do as many projects that don't compromise your integrity as you can, and then hopefully one day you can die happy. And that's really what life is about. Just trying to not compromise yourself too much and die.
That's not Ronnie's fault that we've got to death so early. Literally 20 minutes ago, backstage, I was talking about how I thought I was probably going to die soon and I hoped it was quick. And then Ronnie reminded me if I could survive a year, I'd win some awards. So I...
if you can do a show about it, yeah.
Yeah,
you
critically will. And...
oh my God, you're a genius.
Terminally will, last will and testament. I actually need
three. You're not trying. You're not even trying. That's
I've lost the will to live. There's so many of them. It's like...
you're not even trying. It's ridiculous.
So, you're doing shows here in Australia. In fact, I'm so grateful that you came and did this today because tonight is the first night that you're pretty much, you know, doing this show in front of like a theatre full of people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I was working out in America... And that's the other thing, this goes back to doing something you like doing, not for the tangible benefits. And it's easier to say when you start making money from it, obviously, but like this show that I've worked on, that I'm about to do at the Emmore Theatre, I was working in New York every night, you know, 2-3 times a night I would get spots in New York. I would do my 1 hour, like every 2 days I would do the hour in a small theatre, and just to try it out. And that... to do that, work a full-time job, and then at night do that with a wife, well, I just got married as well. Like, it's crazy. It doesn't make any sense. If you're looking for money or fame, it's the easiest thing to not do. So the only reason we're doing it is because of some weird obsession of like, yeah, I gotta get this next joke, please.
Please, let this joke work.
Right? It's just that... that thing in your head.
So how do you put together like a new show in that regard? Like I'm always fascinated in the craft of it. Do you start collecting things bit by bit? Do you have an overall philosophy?
You're asking me. You're the masterclass on this, man. We go to you to ask you this.
Well, I already know what I think.
Yeah, but
so I know. No point me getting here and interviewing myself for this fucking podcast.
No, it's not. It's like I know there's a theater full of people who are fans of you, but you don't understand. This guy has done like what 25. 1 hour shows? How many have you done? How old are you? You're like 60 now, right? Like what? 25? Is that 30? You've done like 30. Dude, this guy. Hall of Fame. This is Hall of Fame level. It doesn't make any sense. How do you do every year? Like, I'm just like, how do you do it? I'm asking you, you're asking me how I do it?
Yeah.
I look at you and I go, how do you do it?
Okay, but I know how I do it. I want to know how you do it.
All right.
If you want to know how I do it, start your own fucking podcast. Like,
dude, you can spin off anything. Is there anything you can't sell out? Is the question. Any spin off that you are unable to sell?
It's what? I mean, don't overstate my appeal.
So yeah, I mean, how do I do it? I just get really scared, and then I go like, oh shit, people are paying money to watch me now, and then I have.
But who? Okay, so I'll ask you some other questions, and perhaps that we can get to it instead. Who do you like? Who do you watch? Who is it that, like, you know, kind of, who influences you? If you want to look to somebody and say, oh, you know, this is the person who's the career I want or perspective I like or that, you know, enthuses me as a comedian.
Everybody, right? Will's great. I think Tom Gleason's great. Dave Hughes. I'm going to miss a name and everyone's going to be like, oh, you're dissing him. It's like, no, I just thought Dave Chappelle. These guys all have different skill sets. You know, Bill Burr, Todd Barry. All these guys are doing it a long time.
All right. Okay. I'll ask you a different question. I want to get to this. If you could take a skill, like, because all of us, I feel from my point of view that we're all working on getting better and better and better. You try to get one part of what you do right, and then you try to get other parts of what you do right. And maybe over a lifetime, you can get a lot of them right at the same time.
Yeah.
But
what would you like to take? What skills would you love that you could take from other comedians that you feel like you don't have at the moment?
I can't do special effects. I can't do accents. I can't do the great. It's great, mate.
I'm really good at all those things. So,
I can't.
No one can make it to the chopper.
That was a helicopter and...
Oh, that was me. Yeah.
That was you. That was Arnold Schwarzenegger doing a Ronnie impression.
Yeah.
Getting to a broken helicopter.
Yeah, I love to be able to be quick on my feet. I'm not that quick. It takes me a long time. It takes me like a week after this podcast, I'll be like, fuck, I had great jokes. Come up with a great title for Will's dying show. I can't even come up with that on the spot, yeah.
That would be great if we came back in 2 weeks and I asked the same questions, yeah. But you had better answers.
Better answers, yeah.
I can't do that, yeah. I'm actually very limited. I can't do accents. I can't do, you know, I'm not good at talking to people in a crowd. I'm always like, hey, how are you doing? You good? What made you come here tonight? Great. It's dumb. It's so dumb. I can't, you know, I'm not good at, I'm not good at Paul. I can't connect thoughts. I'm really bad at, my job. It's really one thing. Made me realize I'm bad at my job.
No, but here's what I would say. I can't do accents. I can't do voices. I don't have the capacity to write one-liners. Like, the point is that we kind of think that to be a comedian or to be anything, that you need to have all the range of skills that that job has. Whereas in most things, that idea that you would have every single skill, that's like saying that a cricketer or a baseballer or whatever the example could be, has to be able to bowl and bat and wicket keeping. You don't necessarily have to be able to do them all to make it work.
As I've proven, I have no skills, I managed to make it work. But one thing I learned from The Daily Show about comedy writing, okay, first of all, I think I've gotten better at it, hopefully, the last 2 years since I've moved to America. I think the one thing The Daily Show, I think my comedy has matured. I think I've matured as a person a little bit. So one thing at the show we always talk about is what are you trying to say? And so I'm starting with that now with a lot of my comedy. Is like, what are you trying to say with this? Are you trying to say that the environment is in trouble, we should be doing better to help it? You know, we're trying to say that Asian men should be more desirable than they are. Like, what are you trying to say with every joke you're doing? So I think that's a good place to start. Like, what are you trying to say with it? As opposed to just, when I first started out, it was like, just laugh, please laugh. And now it's like, all right, what are we trying to do here? A bit more sophistication.
So, how do you then decide what it is that you want to say? Because that's when comedy gets most interesting to me, is this idea of, you know, authentically connecting with somebody and trying to be completely honest about who you are and what it is that you want to say to people. Yeah. How do you then come up with what that is?
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing I've realized. Doing the TV show, again, I got to plug it, Ryan Chan International Student. We were doing the show about international students in Australia. And when I first pitched the idea, there was an argument made from someone that it wouldn't be very relatable because it's international students, you know. But in Australia, like, who can relate to that other than international students? But
And the people who've been to university with international students.
That's what I thought.
Who understand what a student is and what someone from overseas is.
Exactly.
So this will not appeal to people who don't understand things. No, fair enough, but they're not our key demo, so they don't understand how to turn their telly on. Yeah. So
it's true.
They're literally trying to turn the fireplace on with their shoe.
So that's exactly it. And one thing I realized doing the show, which I suspected before we wrote it, and after doing the show, it kind of cemented it, and I believe more than ever now that, like, authenticity resonates in storytelling, and I think in life, you know, authenticity resonates with people. Even if you have an unrelatable story that you're telling, the fact that the authenticity will make people get behind you. Like, who can relate to a science teacher making math? You know, but we all get behind the story because, you know, there's something about it resonates, the emotions in it. So
The truth at the heart of it, you know, the desperation of somebody who's reached rock bottom, or idea that your skills could be used for something other than, like, I'm often a little bit concerned about the fact that, you know, and bless you, thank you so much for literally coming out to, I was like, hey, I'm going to do a live version of something that you can consume for free, and I'm not going to tell you who the guest is, and you all fucking came and paid money for that, and sometimes I think, fuck, I could really abuse that. Like, if I wanted to start a cult, we could fucking do it, but...
That's what I've been saying the whole time. This is ridiculous that you can spin off two podcasts and then there's still people showing up.
But the point being, that you've got to connect with that authentic moment of understanding. I mean, I loved your show, but it must be hard creating something, I think, from scratch about a unique experience, particularly here in Australia. Talk us about what the experience of making that show was like.
Yeah, I learned a lot making... I've never done anything like that, to write a 7-episode TV show. I've never written a script before that time. And to tell the story...
When you're about to do something that you've never done before,
yeah,
you know, to put it for everyone's example,
yeah,
what A, gave you the courage that you go, well, I can do this thing that I've never done before? And B, what did you do to learn how to do it?
Yeah, I mean, first was, this might not apply for other situations, but it was like I felt very strongly that this was a story that needed to be told. So I don't know if that translates to any other walk of life, but I felt like international students have been coming to Australia for generations, since the 50s, you know, but we have people in Malaysia and Singapore and all around Asia who came to Australia to study, then went back, had kids, sent their kids here, came back, you know, it's generational, it's a multi-billion dollar industry in Australia. And all these people have come through, and it's so much a part of the Australian story. I felt was that the international student story is the Australian story. We've been coming here for generations, and I just felt it was something that I really wanted to show people about, that, you know, people can come fresh off the boat and still be sophisticated people, you know. And so that was what made me try to do it, even though I've never done it before, because I was like, if I don't do it, I don't know who else will be in a position to tell this story. So,
is there ever any pressure? And I guess when you were starting doing comedy, because here's the thing that often happens, right? Which is this idea that we are accepting of others, you know, whatever the other happens to be,
yeah,
as long as the other conforms to the stereotype that we kind of already perceive of the other.
Sure.
And certainly in comedy, comedy was very open to like going, oh yeah, you know, you can be from anywhere as long as all your jokes are about the fact that you're from there or you are that thing. You know, like, yeah, gay comics had it at the start as well. You could be a gay comic, but you had to talk almost exclusively about being gay.
Yeah,
and the same,
gay. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it was the same with like people from, you had overseas experiences. It was almost a demand to constantly talk about those things.
Yeah.
Was that the case when you started still?
Yeah, I mean, when I started, I feel so old saying that. When I started, it wasn't that long ago. I started 2009. It was my own lack of knowing what comedy was, and so I was just doing what I saw was popular, which was Russell Peters at the time. Everyone was like Russell Peters. It was like everyone was forming Russell Peters tribute bands.
Right.
Everyone was doing the jokes. I was walking down the corridors of my university, white guys literally going verbatim Russell Peters routines. You know, I knew it. So. You know, I thought that was how I was supposed to do comedy. So you do it that way. You talk about personal experiences, and then slowly you learn more about it, and you hopefully get better at it, and you start talking about topics which no one else has talked about, right? Which is the goal, to create stuff no one has created yet. Even though everything's derivative, I know, but we try, right? We try our best. So to answer your question, it was like that at the start, but that was a me thing. That wasn't a society pressure. I've never done a gig in Australia where I went on stage and I felt everyone was gonna be terrible to me because I was Asian. Like, I've never done that before.
Toured a lot of North Queensland?
I have. I've done all around Australia. I went to Darwin. I was very lucky to do the road show. I toured all around Australia like twice. Up East Coast, West Coast.
So tell me about that. So if you are not feeling that,
yeah,
because so much of what we see in the news and the media, and I'm not asking you to speak for all people who've had your experience.
All Asians, yeah.
Yeah. On behalf of all Asians, could you please answer me this? No, I am.
We come in peace.
Yeah. Yeah. How much is my house worth?
I can get you a deal.
Yeah. tell me about, because we hear so much in the media here about the xenophobia of Australia, and I know that it must be a real thing because you know you must know that it exists. But just tell me about your experience.
Yeah, my own personal experience is weird because I've been lucky or unlucky to. I've lived in countries where I'm the majority. I've lived in countries where I'm the minority. I spent equal time in both. So. When I came to Australia, it was like, and even when I went to America, it was like, this place is great. It's way better than where I'm from. So there's nothing, like you have to go really extreme to make me go, fuck this place. Because I've seen where I'm from. I'm like, I'm here because it's better than where I'm from. So, you know, you can, I can ask my wife, man. People have spit in my face. I've had on Australia Day, it gets really bad in Melbourne City. But I'm still like that. I'm still okay with that. Like still better than where I came from. So I never had that chip on my shoulder. When I came here, I was never like, fuck this place, man. I have to do comedy for a living. Fuck. This place that supports the arts. Fuck that. Where you can say whatever you want and the government's not gonna come after you. Fuck. You know, so I never had that. I don't know. That's just my, and then it's weird to say that because then you sound like a right-wing dude. If you're not angry at the government, you're right-wing, right? So, yeah, but that's my attitude towards it. So I never went into country towns going, these people are gonna hate me. I just went in just going, oh, I hope they like this. And then it's like, oh, it usually worked out. And I was like, oh, we all survived that first contact of jokes and laughter. I was like, oh, fucking, it worked. Thank God it worked. And then you leave and never see them again.
So what's... what's the power of jokes and humour when it comes to that, though? I mean, I'm sure this is a question you get asked a lot. And yeah. Some people, I think that comedy lives in this, like, you know... Like, here's the thing I know about comedy is that it perhaps can help people. I don't think it changes people's minds.
That's a great question to ask. That's the next thing we should talk about.
Right.
You go first, sorry.
No, here's what my question was going to be. Yeah, yeah. Ronnie, do you think comedy changes people's minds?
No. What were you going to say initially?
Okay, we can talk about this, though, because it's a thing that you get asked a lot as a comedian, right? Yeah. Is this idea of, like, do you do comedy hoping that you can change someone's mind? And firstly, no. Because I don't think that I know enough of... I'm trying to work out what I think about the world, and I get it wrong a lot of the time just about me, so I don't have the arrogance to think that what's right for me or works for me would work for anybody else. Right. But... the second thing is, I've been talking about marriage equality. I know this. My first ever joke about routine about marriage equality was in a show 19 years ago. And I talked about it every single year for the next 14 years after that. And then the only reason I stopped was...
Man, you're old.
I did it for 15 years fucking straight. It changed nothing. We're still having this stupid fucking vote all these years later. I haven't even done a marriage equality bit for 4 years because everywhere else I tour in the world already has it, so that bit doesn't work. So fuck Australia, I'm not writing a bit just for here. So I was getting to fucking Canada and going, what about gay marriage? They're like, yeah, we've had it for a decade, it's fine. And I... dogs might get married. They're like, nah, they didn't. They didn't. They all died unmarried. That's fine. They didn't want to marry us.
Right.
But I guess you've also got to hope that perhaps you can open... If someone's at two doors and they're trying to choose between the two doors,
right,
you can sometimes at least just point them in the direction of the other door. But maybe that's... it. No?
No.
All right, well, tell me what you think.
Yeah, I don't think it changes anyone's mind. I think you come in, you preach to a choir, and then they all laugh, and then we all go home. Nothing changes. I mean, this Donald Trump thing proves that, right? It's a bubble. It's a bubble. We all were like, there's no way. Man, it was a bubble. So, no, nothing matters, and everything is terrible. It's really, the philosophy of this podcast. No, I don't think it changed. I mean, dude, I mean, have you ever changed...
By the way, that's one of the bits I love when it's just me and the guests, but you guys fucking backed off that shit.
Does it? Does it change someone's mind? Has anyone watched a decimation on Facebook where someone decimates racism and gone, yeah, you know what?
No,
yeah.
I agree. I agree. You see it every single day. Yeah. Watch this comedian destroy Trump and you turn
in. Oh, it's over?
And then you're like, oh no, hang on, Trump's still president. Right. No, I get it.
So,
here's what I would say is, perhaps maybe you're a sort of person who has an idea about something and your friends don't have the same idea about that, and in your own head you can't quite put together the words, but you've got the feeling. You know that perhaps we're being unfairly cruel to refugees, but until you went and saw Tom Ballard's show, you didn't quite understand exactly that. You have now some facts and statistics and whatever that you can bring to that conversation at lunch. I don't think you can convince that person to believe something they didn't believe, but perhaps if they already believe it, you can furnish them with some arguments and ideas that they can then use, or at least go, well, it's not just my mates at work who disagree with me. This dude, Tom Ballard, off the telly, he seems like a smart guy.
White savior, Tom Ballard. Yep, I get it.
Yeah.
I love Tom, by the way. That wasn't him. I'm good friends with him. I give him crap all the time. Okay, fine. Look, if you want to have the hopeful, we should all be hopeful as humans, right? Then yeah, hopefully people can change their minds when presented with alternative situations and facts. I think comedy is hard though because you're usually making fun of people. And so, like one of the things that the show was like, one of the first pieces was like, don't call someone racist, call them racially biased. Because if you call someone racist, it shuts down the conversation. So if you say bias, it helps. So the same thing with comedy, it's like, you know, the real way to get Trump voters to not vote for Trump is to talk to them and see what they want, right? Not make fun of them for being idiots. Because you're not going to change anyone's mind. But how many people, like everyone says we don't want Trump. How much do you not want him? Do you not want him enough to go speak to his supporters? Because that's what you got to do to do it. Not watch, you know, John Oliver on Facebook newsfeed and be like, yeah, we won. And then, which by the way, I also love John Oliver. I spoke to him when I first got a job. We can talk about that later.
Let's talk about it now. Okay, cool.
Yeah, that's good. I don't know. We didn't resolve anything there, which is kind of like life, right? We can't.
I don't think anyone came to this fucking podcast going, they'll probably fix racism. I'm not sure who the guest is, but I reckon we'll fix racism.
Yeah. He told me, if we were structuring the show, I would put this segment earlier because when I first got the job on The Daily Show.
Okay, you're not. It's my fucking podcast. It happens how it happens. It's a natural, organic, flowing, interesting conversation where interesting things just pop up.
Sure.
Anyway, John Oliver.
Do you want some more wine then?
Now you're judging my drinking, are you, Ronnie?
So when
you've done this another fucking decade.
Is this my future?
And the Daily Show has fallen apart and you're back at Giant Dwarf angrily hosting a podcast with someone fucking 10 years younger than you.
Who, 20 years younger.
Oh, what the fuck? Bloody Asians coming to this country taking my job.
Bloody Asians going to America to take the job I wanted.
I'm a Trump voter. Get him out. Get Ronnie out. Close the borders.
John Oliver. This goes to my idea that I don't know anything, and so I was trying to look for people to get advice from. One of them was Will Anderson, and we know where that went. So then I was looking for the other correspondent, non-American correspondent on The Daily Show, the only person who could give me advice, which was John Oliver. So and it's a very tight-knit family. It's like this extended family of John Stewart people and all that. They put me in touch with John Oliver. He replied personal email, everything like, hey, meet me at 8 a.m. in my office around the corner from where our offices were. So we went up, sat down with him, and he was, you know, so generous with his time. Just like everyone I've ever spoke to about comedy has always been very sincere with that advice and generous with that time. And he told me it took him 2 years to learn how to do comedy in America. Because he said it took him 2 years to learn their perspective so he could make fun of it. And that's something I learned in America as well. And he was spot on, by the way. It was exactly 2 years. Because I think this is interesting to speak to you about because you have a good perspective on this. I think if you're not American and you go there, you can do jokes. You can kill for 5 minutes. You can kill for 10 minutes. You could probably even kill for 45 an hour. But then if you stay there for too long, you kill as a novelty act. You're like, he's the foreigner coming to make observations, and you can kill. But then if you live there for 6-8 months, it becomes like, this isn't real anymore. The authenticity isn't there anymore because you've lived there long enough to know that, yeah, there's 50 different types of Coca-Colas. So what, you know? So in order to make,
you've got to be like, this guy's been here 8 years. He cannot be as offended by the Outback Steakhouse as he's pretending to be.
Exactly, and so when you spend that much time there, you have to learn how to make fun of them, but no understanding their actual perspective, and that takes time to learn. So I think in Australia it worked out for me because I lived here for 10 years, and so I know I can make fun of, as maybe sometimes I do the hacky outsider joke, but hopefully it's with understanding of the perspective of the Australian. Same in America, understanding actual Americans' perspective. That way when you make fun of it, they know. They know you're coming from you're speaking accurately.
Like, I mean, I think that's one of the things that John Oliver does so wonderfully well, is that he speaks both as an outsider and an insider. It's why his show works in a way that,
you know, shows like that couldn't work, sure, because he manages to be, you know, offended as an American, but also has the outside sort of like, you know, the perspective.
Yeah.
On The Daily Show, because it must be a very fascinating thing to be, because you are, you know, speaking to a divided America in the first place, and then you are an outsider and an insider at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, tell me about, you know, just that idea of working out who you are so sure, you can develop what it is that you want to say. Sure.
I mean, inside baseball here, I actually, when I moved to America, I felt I was already changing my comedic voice. So landing there was like, oh, I didn't know, I was lost for like at least a year and a half, because I think my comedy was maturing, hopefully, and then also I was in another country. But when I first got there, it was, I did my first bit, my first segment. I was so excited to do the first segment. It was about virtual reality, and I went on the Daily Show subreddit to look at the, oh, that was a mistake, and I never went back. I've never seen the Daily Show subreddit since, because people were just, you know, angrily hating, like, and the thing that we're hating about was this guy is being a stereotypical, it was Asian Americans who didn't like it. They were like, this guy's making us look bad, you know, why does he have to put on the accent? Why does he, I didn't even make any real Asian jokes in the thing. I'm pretty sure I didn't, yeah, in the whole piece, but it was inescapable, the accent, so it was like, oh, I'm making them look bad now. Like the Asian Americans were like, yeah, this guy, we're not all foreigners. Why do they have to hire a foreign Asian? Why can't he just be American? Why can't he be Asian but American? Why does he have to be like this, you know?
How do you go receiving feedback? Are you a sort of person who has in the past like looked for it? Do you read reviews? Do you read under like, you know, the YouTube comments?
Oh, yeah. Oh, like, love reviewers, man. They're the best, the most talented people, I think. I think they are so talented to just, instead of creating things, just comment on other people's creation as a living without putting their neck out to do anything. That's really the best job of all. In fact, we should all salute these brave people every day. Yeah, putting their necks on the line to comment on other people's creations. People who sweat blood and tears to make stuff, to do stuff. All you have to do the comment now is, you don't even need your neck muscles to review. You just, you can press it with your balls. You just, it's so easy to rate now, 3 stars. Yeah, reviewers, man, I love reviewers. The best people out there. They're the best. Why try to put yourself out there to do something awesome when you can just sit on your fat ass and watch other people attempt it, and then just criticize when they fail, or, you know, give them kudos when they succeed. Yeah, it's the best job. I would love to be that. If I could restart my life, I would be a reviewer. It's the best. It would be best.
I mean, on the transcript, on the transcript, it'll read fine. That's, you know, the good news is, literally yesterday or the day before, like, my management were like, because this has been sold out for ages.
And yeah, I know.
They were like, hey, there's a reviewer who would like to come and review the show. And I said, no, thank fuck.
Oh, I go into a whole bit on it in the N-more, so. And I say no reviewers. I'm like, I don't use your stars. I'm not going to use your goddamn quotes. I don't want, I've had good reviews, I've had bad reviews. Everyone's like, it sounds like everyone's like, oh, you must have had a lot of trauma with reviewers. And yes, I have, all right? But I've had good reviews, I've had bad reviews. I just don't get this idea that people were trying to do stuff and then they're just coming in and two stars, three stars. No concept of the work it takes to make it.
But in general,
and that's my perspective.
But aren't we in a world now where everything is reviewed? Like, I mean, like you were saying before, like, you know, you take an Uber here, you review it immediately,
you go to
a restaurant, people rate it. But that's what they do, right?
No, it's fair.
They review it, and we are in this society where we are constantly being asked by everything. Stay on the call, answer 3 questions. Give us feedback on what we did right now. You can't rent a car or use the bank or go to a restaurant or any of these sort of things without them asking you immediately, can you give us feedback on this thing? Do you believe we have become, like, I mean, it seems like this is the new economy, right? That everything is rateable immediately.
Sure. I think it's different to rate a car ride, that tip, like 15-minute car ride, to go, oh, yeah, this guy's a 4-star.
By the way, I don't even know how you can get less than 5 stars. If you shut up and get from A to B, that's 5, right?
Oh my God. Like, when I saw my, like, rating, like, yeah. One of the Uber people, like, and it was less than 5, I was like, I have never given less than 5. The driver could literally shit, put it in the side seat,
yeah.
And I'd be like, fuck it, 5 stars, 5 stars.
The things this guy has to do to not get 5 stars is unbelievable. How am I not 5 stars? Anyway. So yeah, reviewers suck is really the point of that. That we shouldn't be. No, but I think that's the difference between someone, you know, athletes trying to working hard every day and training hard, and then people just criticizing their abilities and people trying to create something and a 10-minute car ride. Like,
but tell me this then. Then how do you get feedback? Because everybody needs feedback, right? Everybody needs.
No, I don't need feedback. I'm good. No, okay. Here's the answer to your question. To get feedback, you get feedback from people who are qualified to give it. I'm not gonna listen to fucking the IT guy from the Brisbane Times and what he thinks about comedy. Okay, I'm gonna go ask Will Anderson. Hey, what do you think about this? He's been through the trenches. He knows. What do you think about this? He'll give actual usable advice. You know, I don't want to hear from amateurs about people trying to do stuff. Anyway.
How are you at giving advice? Like, if someone comes to you and says, hey, Ronnie, like, you know, I've admired what you do. Like,
yeah, people come to you, that's different, right? If people ask you, hey, what do you think about this? What's your layperson opinion on this? Then, yeah, you go, yeah, okay, maybe this. And I always hedge it. I'm always like, look, I don't know anything about ballet, but you probably could have jumped a bit higher on that. Look, I mean, you asked me, I'm not trying to get into a thing here. I'm just, to be honest, I thought you could have landed that a little better.
I imagine walking into an environment like The Daily Show, and not just The Daily Show, the Comedy Cellar in New York, for example, you're amongst the greatest comedians in the world, like, and the finest minds in the world, and people who've been doing these sort of jobs for years, right? Well, not exclusively.
A lot of crazy people too, but yes.
A lot of crazy people too, right? Yeah. I mean, but you are also alongside some of the greatest people who've, you know, done these jobs.
Okay.
How is that environment? How do you find yourself in an environment where you suddenly are, you know, coming on after Amy Schumer or Dave Chappelle or
Madonna? One time I got bumped by Madonna one time.
Hang on, what?
Yeah, Madonna came and did a set at the Cellar, and I had to. It was my spot, and she took my spot.
Hang on.
Yeah.
What? You mean? Yeah. Madonna?
Yes.
The
Madonna.
The Madonna.
Yeah, yeah. Not the.
Not the Madonna. Yeah, but like, yeah. I mean, what a fucking miracle. But I mean, later on, if she's back, later on. She's got 15. She's been thinking about it.
What if Madonna got.
Any Jews in? I am.
Imagine Madonna coming on and bombing. How disappointing is that? The hype behind it.
Madonna, oh my God. Oh. So hang on. So you were side stage and you were about to go on, and they're like, Ronnie, we're gonna have to bump you because Madonna.
Yeah, Madonna came.
Is on.
Yeah.
And so, because she did like a spoken word comedy thing, didn't she? Like,
she actually did a double act with Amy Schumer. So she came on with Amy Schumer.
So it was Madonna and Amy Schumer.
Yeah, yeah. And before that was Louis, before that was Jon Stewart.
So, hang on.
And before that was Aziz, and then before that was Pete Holmes.
Pete Holmes, Aziz.
Jon Stewart.
Louis.
Amy.
And then Amy Schumer doing a duet with Madonna.
Yes. That was a very crazy show, yes.
I love how, like, literally 2 minutes ago, I said you hang out with some famous people, and you're like, no, I'm mostly crazy.
Yeah.
You're standing side stage waiting to go. Did you actually get on? Did you have to follow Madonna and Amy Schumer?
No, I did not follow Madonna. She actually did pretty well, which was actually kind of frustrating that she could just walk on, and it was great, yeah.
What sort of material was Madonna doing? I mean, she is the material girl, so.
Yeah. Oh my God. We'll just hear the
fucking
audience.
You make up your own jokes that quickly about Madonna. Are these things on? So
Will just gave the audience the middle finger. She just talked about being famous and being Madonna, and it was like unique material. It wasn't hacky Madonna stuff. It was very unique personal experiences, and Amy Schumer like guided her through it, and everyone was losing their minds. Yeah, it was great. It was a great night. It's a Tuesday.
It wasn't generic Madonna material.
Yeah.
Knock knock. Who's there? My bra just hit the door. I am.
Yeah.
Pretty good Madonna joke. Anyway, fuck you, Ronnie. Fuck you, Ronnie.
You're so old.
I know. That's my only Madonna reference, was her spiky bra 15 years ago. I don't know. Is there new Madonna stuff? What's her newer stuff?
What's the newer stuff?
Yeah, exactly. That's the peak Madonna. Okay, so when you're in an environment like that, are you...
when you're in an environment like that, what do you do?
I like the idea. I mean, are you friendly with, you know, Louis and Amy and like people like that? Does it become its own? Because I mean, the comedy community in Australia.
Yes.
You are backstage constantly, and this is the great thing about it. I remember being a young comedian, and one of the greatest things in the world was that I suddenly would find myself backstage with Greg Fleet or Judith Lucy or Anthony Morgan, all these people that I had just, grown up, admiring.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, you know, so is it the same sort of environment there for you?
No, I mean, I'm getting it right now. Even just being here with you, it's like, I gotta play it cool the whole time. In the back of my head, I'm like, but the whole time you just gotta be like, yeah, Will, you wanna talk about how I write comedy? Yeah, let's do it. Same at the Cellar, when these people come in, like, you're expected to stay professional and don't take selfies. And then there's also like an element of like, let's not borrow someone's fame to like enhance your own. Let's just have a moment here, you know, and sit down. So there's a little bit of that as well, which is my philosophy, runoffly on that. I'm very bad at pronouncing things as well. It's another deficit in my act, pronunciation issues. Like just stay in the moment and be, you know, and I don't know, it's weird with that we are in a job that requires self-promotion, and I don't know, you seem like a pretty naturally kind of, you know, down-to-earth guy, but it's part of your job to be like, I'm the best, you have to come, or else who's going to come watch you? If you don't promote yourself, who's going to come watch your show? So you have to be like, yeah, I'm really good at comedy, but really in your head you're like, oh, I'm not sure I'm still going to do it.
I mean, comedy's a hard one to promote. Like sometimes people will get mad at you like telling about like the fact that you've got shows on online or whatever, and like, I mean... people do, but I do think that you, like, I hope that what you are making, like when you start to make something, you hope it'll be worth people seeing, right?
But you know.
You hope that it will, right? Mm-hmm. And then you want to tell people to come and see it if you've worked hard at it, like,
sure.
I don't think there's any shame in that, but there is, it's awkward for us because our natural position is not to
is like insecure
about.
and that's interesting, America versus Australia as well. I mean, I think Australia...
Well, how do you find that?
Yeah, Australia, very much down to earth, right? We like people who win but don't try. Like, don't try. Don't try. If you try, fuck you. But you win. We love winners, but you gotta not try winning. That's why Bradbury. Bradbury's the champ, right? He won without trying. That's why even Paul Hogan was the guy on the bridge. He was the guy on the bridge. He was drilling stuff in the bridge. One day they interviewed him. He's like, hey, what do you think about this? He was like, I don't know. And then he was like, oh my God, this guy's funny. You should do a comedy show. And he was like, oh, okay, maybe I'll do a comedy show. And fucking kills it. He's just without trying. You just got to win without trying. And so America's different, right? America's like...
So we've got so many things to talk about, and I didn't bring a watch out here. Can you tell me what time it is, mate down the front?
It's still early.
No, just tell me, because Ronnie has a show to do as well. So just tell...
4:15?
Oh, 4:15. 15. Oh, okay. That's all right. We've still got some time, right?
Cool. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, cool. What time do you have to be done by?
I don't even know. What time's the show? 6? Is it 6? My show's at 6.
Okay, so. All right. So we've got like another... Can we have another half an hour?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Is that right, Kat? I don't even know. That's how dependent I am on my handlers. I can't even... What am I supposed to do now?
Well, there's a lot of other things I want to talk to you about. I've talked to you about comedy a lot just because I'm excited about comedy, but there's a bunch of other things I'd like to talk to you about if you don't mind.
Yeah, please.
You got married this year. You don't have to tell me anything that you don't want to tell me.
Okay.
But,
we had passionate sex that night. Yeah.
Well, you got married three times though, right?
Yeah, got married three times to the same woman. Yeah, it's my...
Good to point that last bit out.
Got married three times to the same woman.
So why did you get married three times?
It was my marriage equality protest. I got married three times because I'm more scared of my mom than gay people. It's really what I said. She wanted. So if you're okay. So my wife's family's from Melbourne, Australia. So we had to get married in Melbourne, Australia.
Yeah.
Then we got married in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, even though I'm not from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, but who cares what the groom wants, right? who knows about Malaysia, just whatever the landmark is, nobody cares. And then we had to get married in New York for visa purposes. So three very romantic weddings.
I mean, that's such a comedian's wedding. You've got the rule of three and the last one's the funny one. But
And we actually had a great time at all three of them because I took the time to get like a photographer and we had a great time at all three of them. Yeah.
Can I ask you about, and again, this podcast is certainly not in front of people about giving away anything that you're not comfortable talking about.
Okay.
I'm not going to ask like anything too rude. I want to say
anal, yes or no. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you have three honeymoon nights, by the third one, you're like, nah, it's for visa purposes. Bloody immigrants always coming in the back way. So I would not make that sort of joke if it was just the two of us alone, but I'm a crowd pleaser, Ronnie, but... No, I want to talk to you about the idea of like love and relationships. Was it something that was always important to you? Like, were you a romantic person? Was like love an important thing to you?
Oh man, my wife is here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good time to say good things.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, it's great. I guess, I don't know. I just found someone and then you don't want to look anymore. She's gonna kill me. No, of course.
That was actually his wedding vows. After the first wedding, she was like, "Can you change that?" He's like, "No, nah, I'm sticking with it. I'm doing it. It's killing."
No, of course you love someone. Yeah, you love someone, and you decide.
Were
to marry
you a
them.
Person? I want to know more about what love meant to you before you found her. Were you a person who was looking for love? Were you a person who felt like love was something that was really important to you?
This
were you a romantic
revealing.
Person?
This is very revealing. I've never spoken about this. I'm kind of known as the stoic guy, so I can't really. It's really off-brand for me to talk about.
Well, you don't have to. You can.
Yeah.
You can
okay. I was a hopeless romantic. I always kept falling in love with people who didn't love me back. And then, I always tried too hard to... I would get fixated on girls I liked. I would have crushes. And these crushes would like span oceans. Like, I would fall in love with like people in Singapore. And then I'd be in Australia. And I'd have to go back and totally embarrass myself. And then come back to Australia. And so I had a lot of missteps with love. Yeah, but I always... felt too hard, too strong.
Did you know, like, was there a time where you just went, this is the person that I want to marry three times?
Yeah, I think so. When we broke up once for 2 years and then we got back together. And then the second time we got back together was like, all right, now all the cards on the table. You know all the shit. I know all the shit. If we get back together, it's better now.
It's funny, isn't it? Because like sometimes I hear people talk about when it comes to romance that idea that if you break up with somebody, like if it's over, it should be over forever. But I'm a person who has certainly gone the opposite direction in that, and I do think there is something amazingly liberating and wonderful about the idea that that other person knows all the terrible things about, but not only do they know the terrible things about you, but you know that they've thought all the terrible things about you, because when you break up with someone, that other person has thought, they've just gone through the memory of shit that they thought was nice about you and turned it around into terrible, and if you've made it back together after that, I think there's something really
I think so, yeah. Hopefully you come back stronger, or or it's a abusive relationship and you have to, you couldn't let go of each other.
Right, we'll do another podcast in 10 years and we'll see how it turned out. Yeah.
I meant toxic, not abusive, sorry.
Are you a person who... Do you want kids? Are you like thinking that you...
Dude, you're killing me right now. My wife is right here. I don't know what, like...
Oh, these are her questions.
So
sorry, I've run out of my own questions. She gave me 5 backstage.
No,
the last one is, can you stop doing that anal bit?
Well, you mean the bit or in real life? We went there. That's the when you meant you normally can edit stuff out, but now you can't.
Oh, I can edit it out of the podcast, but I cannot edit it out of her mind.
I thought you were gonna say something else. I love my wife. She's great. That's why I married her. She's awesome.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Kids, it always seems 5 years away. Because I was running. So in New York, I do a daily show in a day. Then at night, I do stand-up shows. I book in as many shows as I can, 3-4 shows a night. And sometimes I'm going home at 1 a.m. on a train, and I'm like, oh, if I had a kid, it'd be dead now. Because I haven't thought about it. I haven't... I know I'm totally in this for me, so maybe I shouldn't have a kid, because, yeah, it would have ended badly if I had a baby.
I mean, I feel like if you had a kid, you wouldn't have booked that 1 a.m. slot.
I don't know.
But I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, well, it's not something that you're thinking about right now. What do you think about in your future, then? So, if you're not, like, I mean, what is it that you think you might be doing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now?
I don't know. I mean, I think the point of what I've been saying this whole time was I really had to adopt this samurai mentality when it came to doing this job. You know, not worrying about the 5-year plan, not worrying about, and that's programming that I really had to deprogram for myself. And so I kind of stopped thinking about the future right now. I'm just kind of making cool stuff in the moment, just trying to keep it going until someone says, get the fuck out. And then I'll go back to Malaysia and die.
So
Malaysia is a good place to die. It's very cheap. It's very cheap to die there.
Ronnie is the new face of Malaysian tourism, man.
Malaysia, it's cheap to die.
Just try to bring some drugs in, they'll do it for you. But I... Too real, right?
So I guess my exit strategy is Malaysia,
I'm interested in that, though, because...
Isn't that awful? I just call my home country an exit strategy? It's a third choice? Fuck.
Mate, fuck it. That's what I call the family farm. They can bury me under the cows.
I think we're becoming more global, though. You know, I don't think of it...
The world is, you mean?
Yeah, I mean,
Do you think it is? Because here's the thing about America. Like, I've spent, like,
25 years there, yeah.
Half of the last 8 years. So I've spent about 4 whole years, but I do half a year there, half a year. And I've spent more time back here recently because I suddenly realised that living half a life in one place or the other was you were living no life in either of the two places. I think you have to be a bit 9 or 3.
Like in that movie with the Hugh Jackman and the Christian Bale.
Wolverine.
No. The magic one.
Logan.
No, the magic one.
Yeah, the Prestige.
The Prestige.
No, don't fucking correct me on a Nolan movie front row. I knew I was just pretending for comedic purposes, but...
The Prestige, yeah. You can't be Christian Bale. You gotta be one or the other. You gotta kill your twin, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, spoilers. But, I'm gonna leave the stuff in about anal, but I'm cutting out the fucking Prestige spoilers.
Yeah, you were living half a life, you and then...
Right, you're living half a life. You want one or the other, and to me, America at the moment, so this is what I want to ask you about. America at the moment, I felt like I had less relevant things to say because it feels like they're involved in a war against themselves. Like, America is two things. They're a couple who are fighting every time you go out to dinner with them, and you realise you can't fix their problems. They need to fix their problems before you can hang out with them again. And that's how I feel a bit about my experience in America. How do you feel?
I kind of agree, but one thing, just on your point of that, is that it's that way by design. It was designed that way. The system of government was designed that way. The system of government was designed to be slow, ineffective, and constantly fighting against itself to prevent someone from taking over and abusing it. And so you get a lot of freedoms, like the iPhone. You get the freedom to create an iPhone. You also get Donald Trump. So if you want iPhone 10, you gotta accept that Donald Trump might ride. Like, so my point is that the all these stuff that we don't like about it, because we're not from there, is stuff that is actually what they are about. And it's so cliche to say, but you gotta take the good with the bad in that country. So the inefficiencies they're talking about, the fighting, the constant fighting, was they programmed that into the constitution. The division, the separation of powers, makes it very hard for anyone to efficiently get shit done. You know,
it's fascinating, that perspective, because I think that's a really unique perspective. Right. Tell me what it is you think about Australia from the perspective of somebody who has been both in us and one of us, like in a lot of your pivotal moments of your life, but you're also not from here, and you've also gone away, and you've got an external perspective to Australia. What's your sense of what this country is? What is its strengths and limitations?
Yeah, I think it's such a great country, and I think it's hard for people to see it because they haven't lived elsewhere sometimes. That, like, the differences between left and right here, okay, they're pretty great. Like, there's huge differences, but, like, sometimes elections, it's like you, there's nothing much to complain about. Like life here is pretty good. The wages are very high. People, okay, the stereotype of like the fat, lazy American is like, no, man, if you go to America, most people are working like three jobs. Like they're a nurse and then an Uber and then they're doing something else. Like here, people can make a good living doing things. You don't have to tip. Oh my God. We don't have to tip. The price is what it is, right?
We would prefer if you leave a tip if you enjoyed the show, though. So just
yeah. So I feel like it's very high standard of living here, and there's not much to really be angry about.
When I mean, I think sometimes that is the case, right?
Yeah.
We find these tiny things to be angry about because our standard of living is so high here.
Yeah. That obviously, there's huge issues like the Manus Island stuff and the all this other. There's important issues, but I'm just saying sometimes the little nitty gritty, it's like, what was that thing? I remember, maybe I'm ignorant in this, making a joke about this, but that guy who gave the carbon tax, this big deal about the carbon, what was the tax that they gave back, they refunded the tax, and it ended up being like $100 a household?
Ah, Kevin Rudd.
Yeah, what was that thing they gave back to people? It's like, we're going to repeal the shit. We're going to repeal this tax, and it became like $100 a household. And I was like, are you serious? All that was over $100 a household. You can't even buy, you can't buy anything for $100. You can't even come to watch my show for $100. That's how it is.
Can't see you. How much does your ticket cost for a show tonight?
You know, with
what does it cost tonight? What does it cost tonight to see your
involved,
show?
Right,
what does it cost?
I came from a long
what
way away.
What does it cost to see your
show?
It's
all going to me, all right? Ticketmaster takes a cut.
How much does it cost?
Sorry, $50. Sorry. But then if you get two, you can't, I'm trying to make a point here. You're fucking undermining me.
I just wanted to make sure you weren't charging more than me.
Yeah.
But I am!
Yeah, so that stuff, I'm a bit like, come on, man. An environment is worth more than $100 a household. Give me a break.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. So, Ronnie, I've got a couple more questions. I know that we have to go. Yeah. You've got two shows tonight?
I got
two
shows tonight,
How do you go when you do two shows?
I'm okay.
Yeah. Are you, like... I love this guy's trying to sneak out. It's okay, it's fine. It's a podcast, mate. It's fine. It doesn't matter. It's okay. We've gone longer. You've got your money's worth. You can fuck off. It's like... He might need to go to the toilet. He might be coming back. I needed to go to the toilet. If we go for much longer, I'm going to be glad I'm wearing black pants. But I...
Melbourne trained you to do... one show a night for like a month. Melbourne Comedy Festival. You're doing, it builds up a real marathon muscle with comedy. So,
Ronnie, I want to talk to you about so many things, but we need to finish up, and I always talk about a couple of things before we finish.
Yeah.
What do you think happens when you die?
Nothing. I think you just die, then it's black, and then that's it.
Pretty much everyone I have on says that.
Yeah.
But was that something that you always thought?
No. I used to believe in something else.
What did you believe in?
I watched too much Christopher Hitchens, and now it's over.
You used to believe that women...
No, I used to have, religion... No, I used to be the religious...
The traditional thing. Religious sort of...
Yeah, idea. I think for some reason my family is traditionally Buddhist Taoist in Malaysia. Don't worry about it. I know, questions, don't worry about it. When you burn joss sticks... Incense, don't worry about it. Okay, so we want that stuff. In Malaysia, it's very common, but it's, I know.
I mean, I've lived with a lot of stoners, it's pretty common. It's an incense, you get your best incense at the fucking weed store. That's how it works.
And then, for some reason, my mom would read us the Bible when I was a kid. For no reason, she wasn't Christian, she just read the Bible. And then you started getting, programmed by that. You start thinking about all this stuff, and anyway. So
when did you decide that was not for you?
Yeah, in high school, then I went to university, and I tried to date Christian girls, and never worked out, and that was what turned me against Christianity. Yeah, it was a lot of... it was weird. It was like when you would date a Christian girl in university, if they were Asian from overseas, man, you would date them, and suddenly this whole organization would come and be like... No, literally, they'll be like, are you Christian? We hear you're dating this girl. Are you Christian? Maybe you should come and join us on Sundays. And I was just like, I didn't want this. Yeah, I was like, fuck that. And then And also, she didn't like me, which also helped. But yeah.
So with the idea that you don't think that anything happens when we die, what do you think that life... What is the reason for it? How did it happen?
Oh, there's no reason for it. It's an accident.
Okay, but if it is an accident... Yeah. Oh, by the way, anyone who's listened to this before knows this is exactly what I believe.
Sure.
But I guess
please, devil's advocate. Yeah.
Well, no, but I guess this is why I started the podcast in the first place. Yeah. Because I think that
the reason this podcast exists is this question. I believe that we are an accident in the corner of the universe, and then when we die, we're done forever. So, if that is true, then why is what we have this? Why does it have so much meaning? Why, if we are just a fucking random accident of evolution, does the fact that you and I on this stage talking to these people have some actual fucking meaning? Because it shouldn't. It should mean fucking nothing. And so, what
I think it does.
So anyway, could you solve that for us? Yeah. And then it'll be worse doing this fucking show live.
Here,
and leave the harp on.
No, it means nothing. Nothing means anything. That's really the answer to that. I think what we feel...
So then how do you give things meaning?
Yeah, well, what we feel right now is emotions. Hopefully we've had a good time. We've learned some stuff about how to deal with issues in our life. Because unhappiness is a real thing, right? And so because unhappiness is real, we're trying to alleviate that. So I think life is trying to alleviate unhappiness, right? It's very Buddhist. You know, everything's always changing. Nothing means anything. So, I don't know, man. I'm sorry, I wish I had a pithy joke here.
You don't need to. I just like to know. Yeah. How do you, when you get up and you give your wife meaning, you give your job meaning, you put
through
your
anal,
jokes meaning?
No,
I did not realize that was going to be the answer to this question.
Through human connections, right? That's what it is, right? I mean, that's the cliched answer. That's what people tell me I'm supposed to say.
What you think?
Yeah, I think so. That's what we feel right now, right? We only feel emotions in the present. Like, stay in the present, what emotions we're feeling right now is real. And so you have to try to make sure those are pleasant emotions and not unhappy emotions. And we get that through, like, helping other people. Some people who aren't psychos actually get joy from helping other people. Some of us get joy from solving problems, right? Or creating stuff.
What gives
some
you
fucking
joy?
Assholes get joy from reviewing other people. For some reason.
What's your joy? What's your happiest place? When you're at your, like, if you say, I can only do one more thing.
Yeah.
I've got like a day left.
Yeah.
And I want to do something. What is that something?
Yeah, I'm sorry, man. I think you caught me at a very nihilistic period of my life where I'm just like, nothing is anything. But maybe
I like
maybe
to think of it as a willilistic.
Yeah.
Because I'm always about the branding.
Yeah. Maybe in 30 years when I'm your age, I'll have a different perspective. But right now, it's a bit like, so you find meaning by doing cool stuff, right? By living in the moment, doing cool stuff, right? Making cool stuff, making other people laugh. That's why we do this. We're very lucky to be in a job that doesn't hurt other people. I think everyone else is doing something that's like associated with something that's doing something horrible, but we get to just call them out by making people laugh, right? I don't know, that's pretty fun. I've had a good time. That's why I said, back to my first answer to you, was I had a very clear moment of clarity on stage at the Cellar. When I was performing, I was like, oh, this is what it's like to be happy. It's awesome, yeah, just stay in the moment. And yeah, it's very rare, very fleeting to try to capture that. Also, when I married my wife, I also had that feeling. Yeah, she's great. I'm sorry, man. I wish I could solve your... But you have more years on me. You have a better answer to this than... Again, another...
I have no answers. Otherwise, I would not have started this podcast.
Right.
Sorry, okay. Last but not least. I guess if people could remember something about you, like if it got to the end of your life and, you know, people look back and they go, this is what Ronnie was about, or this is what we think Ronnie was about, what would that be for you?
Yeah, he tried his best. That's what he tried his best. He tried. I think that would be, that's what I want on the, he tried.
I fucking love it. Ladies and gentlemen, Ronnie Chang. Yeah, thank you so much for coming out to this very first thing. I hope you had a good time. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.